Bag session number 14053, reel 2.
Mr. Henderson, reel 2.
The area we covered was the South Swamp. From my recollection, it appears to be about an area of about 30 miles by 30 miles. It was a swamp. You literally walked into it and down to it. It was an area during the war that the Japanese tried to drain. They cut a huge swathe, a huge oblong, out of the swamp and tried to drain it. It's called the Rentis, R-E-N-T-I-S. Having got back there, I was then posted to 10 Platoon D Company, and we then commenced operations in the swamp. Most of the operations took about 10 days. What we used to do is take 5 days' food supply with us, and then either was resupplied on foot, or we took an airdrop, which, if that was the case, we either got to a space that had already been cut or had to cut ourselves a space so that the 99 Company Royal Corps of Transport and their aircraft were able to drop all the parachutes to us. I suppose in a normal airdrop we got 8 to 10 parachutes. The main parachute anybody looked for was the rum ration. Nobody worried about the food too much until we actually got the parachute where the rum ration was dangling on the end, and everybody was happy about that. These operations in the swamp continued, I suppose, for well over a year. They were broken up to a certain extent when we moved to a place called Kajang. One of the successes of the Malayan campaign is the food denial. If the bandits' food supply could be cut off, and they were supplied with food from the local villages, we were going to win this campaign, and that is one of the reasons why we did win it in the end. So again, coming from the jungle, we were sent out to these small villages and moved into small huts within the village. And 5 o'clock in the morning, the platoon used to go out to all the road checks at the entrances and exits to the village, where we had to search the rubber tappers. We did have female Malay police for the ladies, and to check that they were not carrying any rice out with them. And if you can imagine the feelings at 6 o'clock in the morning with a piece of stick swirling round in what I loosely term as the night soil buckets that were carried out from the villages, looking for packets of rice. It wasn't a very nice occupation. The Gurkhas played a blinder once at a village. They saw one of the trucks queue jumping all the way up to the exit, so they let it come all the way up. They pulled it to one side, took all the wheels off, thoroughly stripped the truck and left it. That truck didn't do any queue jumping anymore. They also had one glorious morning, I think the Gurkhas there, where they actually searched the women. This made the papers in England at the time, and obviously questions were asked in the house. But nevertheless, it did happen, but I think only once. We then also, while we were there at Kajang, commenced operations throughout the area. A lot of rubber around there. One of the companies did have an incident, and one of the sergeants, Sergeant Westall, got the MM out of it, where they were on patrol and they saw some bandits ahead of them. The sergeant said to the officer, just a minute, sir, don't go ahead, because that somebody might be, you know, waiting to ambush us. The officer ignored this, as far as I know, went ahead, and there was a bandit duly dug in a small trench who opened fire and killed the officer. The sergeant then took over, shot some bandits, picked up the bandit's shotgun, reloaded it with ammunition, and with him and the rest of the platoon, I think they killed two or three bandits. But a very, very brave man, this sergeant. He, I say, he got the MM.
For what was his name?
Sergeant Westall. He lives up in Wiltshire at the moment, but I just don't know where he is at all. The main incident, I think, that happened, two incidents really with us, was we were sent out, the platoon, which was about 20, 25 people. We were given information that bandits were going to carry rice, food, from this village along this track to another destination, probably within the next 10 days. So we duly went out late afternoon and bashed up, which literally means we set up camp, because our little places were called bashers, which we lived in. We set up camp. And at night, I think from 7 o'clock in the evening, we ambushed this track, which did cross what we would say in England was about a C-class road. It was a metal road. And we ambushed it rather like on a dog leg, with people looking over the track and people looking over the road. Well, the first night, nothing happened at all. The second night, I decided to move one or two people in different positions, and we duly settled down for the night. I believe that it was my turn to be most alert then, so I had the Bren gun, the 303 Bren gun. About 10 o'clock at night, I suddenly saw in front of me, not more than 5-10 yards, three shadowy figures that appeared to be carrying sacks on their back. I had to stand up, turn to my left, and I opened fired with the Bren gun, and I heard somebody yell. Then the other lads obviously started firing as well. We stopped firing. We didn't know if we had hit anybody, but we suspected it. We didn't want to move because the other two could have gone to ground and would have fired back at us. Another sergeant, Sergeant Gibbs, came along and he said, "You cover me, I'll stand up and I'll blast the area," again with a Bren gun, which he did. So nothing more happened that night. We stayed where we were. The CO came out, and I think other people and the local police force that we always liaised with joined up with us. We told them what had happened. We then decided we would do a sweep in front of us as to roughly where these bandits had gone. So we moved about 300 yards with the road as our axis, and on the right we heard a moaning. Now, it could have been one of two things. It could have been a buffalo, which do get around in the area, or it could possibly be this bandit who we assumed had been shot. So we stopped and we listened, and then the police took over, the Malay police, and they went over to the right, and I think within 20 yards they'd come upon this one bandit out of the three, and he had a bullet wound in his ankle. He was then duly taken away by the police, and the incident was finished. Later, I and two or three of the platoon had to go to the High Court in Kuala Lumpur to give evidence against this particular Chinese bandit, who we saw in court with all plastered up ankle. His defence counsel pleaded that he had an ancient mother, he'd been led into all this, he had his family to support. I can always remember the judge listening carefully to this, and he stopped after about 10 minutes and said, "Would you mind telling the accused that the only possible sentence I can give him is that he be taken from here to a place of execution and hung? Next case, please." So that was the end of the bandit. The story continues 2 weeks later. I was sent for again by the company commander, Major Symes, about 11 o'clock in the morning. The information he'd received was that two bandits had been seen by rubber tappers. within 2 miles of the area of the initial ambush. I was to go and choose from my platoon about 3 or 4 other people, go out ahead of the 2 companies that were concerned with this, and take up a position where I could look down, looking at the map and the contours, over a large area. I was to go on ahead, maybe an hour and a half, 2 hours ahead of the main 2 companies, and just sit there, which we did. During the afternoon, the companies had obviously come out. One was well ahead of us in ambush, facing back towards us in case the bandits ran through them. My company came up from behind me. We joined up. I was asked if I'd seen anything. We said no. Well, within a minute of that, we'd got over this small ridge, looked down ahead of us, maybe 100, 200 yards, and it was rubber. It was fairly clear. And we saw these two figures running along. Well, they were obviously the 2 bandits that we missed on the night ambush. I came up into the shoulder just about to fire at them. And Major Simon said, no, don't fire. So obviously he knocked my rifle up. And he then grabbed 4 or 5 other people and hurtled off down to the left, chasing these bandits. They disappeared from our view, and then we heard a lot of firing. We then got called forward, and these 2 bandits had duly been shot and killed. So it was quite a good operation, that we'd started about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and we were back home with these 2 bandits by 6 o'clock in the evening. The operation completely finished.
Where and when was this?
This must have been in 1955, I should think. It was February 55.
Where was it near?
It was near the village of Simuni. I can't really spell it. It's one of these strange names. But that is the nearest village that it happened. Because my night ambush, there was articles in the English papers, gun battle at Simuni. And it did reach the English papers describing, you know, what had happened that night. It wasn't really a gun battle as such, but I think they blew it up that way.
Did you feel that the guerrilla that you saw in the court had been dealt with properly?
Yes, because the rules and regulations said that anyone caught in the jungle, in the rubber, with a gun, and he had a gun, was liable to get the death sentence. That was the law in those days in Malaya. They were bandits, and they were either shot by the security forces or hung by the judiciary. If a bandit surrendered, well, fair enough. I had another incident one day where the company commander sent for me again. He said, look, we've got 8 surrendered bandits want to come along and fire our rifles. I said, what? I said, you're kidding. He said, no. He said, you take the necessary precautions, but they are allowed. They're friendly bandits. They will come over onto our side. Given a lot of information, they would like to fire our weapons. So we took them on the range, and I had, I think, a corporal with a loaded rifle behind every bandit, and we duly gave them our rifles and so on. And they fired them that afternoon. But it's one of these funny little things that comes on. I went again on a patrol with a surrendered communist terrorist, closely watched by a Malay, I think a Chinese policeman. But he was there. He'd obviously seen the light and was giving information to us. Nothing happened of that particular patrol. But quite a number did surrender, and I think provided the police with information. Another incident, again, we had one night. Again, Major Symes sent for me and said, in the local village of Kajang, special branch have overheard a Chinese saying he knows where there's a food supply. Get some people together. You're going to go out with him and see if we can find it. So we did. And we seemed to go on. We went out, I think, about 7 o'clock in the evening. And we went on and on and on till about 10 o'clock in the evening, where this supposed informer stopped And he said, dig here. So we duly started to dig, and lo and behold, to our utter surprise, we actually found a food supply. It was rather large square tins, mainly full of porridge oats, which I think they ate as well as rice. But we actually found this a food supply that night and destroyed it, or you know, took it back and got rid of it.
Why were you so surprised?
Well, we just didn't believe this informer. I think other things had happened as well. You get a little bit sceptical at times on information, but this particular night was quite true. As I say, because of that, we were surprised and quite delighted as well that we'd actually gone out, done something and found something.
Was he Chinese or Malay?
I think he was Chinese.
Did you have anybody to help you with the tracking?
Yes, we had a number of people from Borneo, the Dayaks, came over, and how we did it was normally he led, followed by an NCO, and then followed by possibly some more soldiers, then your headquarters. They were very good, the elder ones. I think the younger ones, some of them, were not so good. But from my experience, the one that we used to have with us, he was very good. I can remember one incident. Well, two incidents. We were going down a track, and suddenly there was a noise ahead of us. I looked round, and the whole platoon had disappeared into the undergrowth. And the Iban tracker turned round and smiled and just pointed up into the trees and sort of said, monkeys. And another time I was going down a track with him and he stopped and pointed. I couldn't see what he was pointing at, so he did it again. He said, look, look. And within 2 or 3 yards, there was a rather large snake stood up looking at me. But because it blended with the background, I couldn't see it, but he did. They were very good on tracking as well. They could literally tell you how long a footprint had been in position, how long a twig had been broken, all those sort of things that you could relate and say, ah, yes, we were chasing the bandits. We had an instance on that where we were in the South Swamp. We were going along and suddenly everybody stopped, pointed, and within a few yards, we were in the middle of a bandit camp. The huts were there, all the equipment was there, the pots and pans were there, some clothing was there. What had happened? These bandits had heard us coming. We could then see that there was nobody there, they'd gone. And the Iban trackers quickly looked round and picked up the tracks of these bandits. And we threw literally all caution to the wind as to going very slowly, and we literally tried to run as fast as these bandits had gone, knowing they were much lighter armed and clothed than we were. And we could still see the tracks along the top of logs where it was wet, or the wood had actually splayed out where the foot had gone down and where they jumped off. But we couldn't catch them. And strangely enough, those tracks led to this village that these bandits that we did the ambush on came from sometime later, but I couldn't give you a time scale on that. But, the Iban trackers were very good. They had all these systems of tattoos, and one of our Iban trackers actually killed somebody in battle. I wasn't there at the time, but the company went out one day on very, very good information, ambushed a bandit camp, and killed 12 out of 13 bandits in one go. It was the biggest successful operation in the whole Malayan campaign. Nobody can compare that, but I wasn't there at the time. I was back in Kuala Lumpur, again, doing my instructional side of it. And having this Iban tracker, having killed the bandit, he shot him with a shotgun, was able to have a special tattoo put up on his chest or on his neck. And that tattoo depicted that he had killed a person in battle. And when he got back to Borneo, obviously he was going to be a man of status. But that's the way they did it. One or two of the lads had tattoos from the Iban trackers, but it was a bit taboo because of the sort of primitive way they did it, with a nail and some ink and so on. It's a little bit primitive there.
What was the relationship between the guerrillas and the local population, as far as you can
initially
see?
Initially, in the beginning of the campaign, I think the locals were fairly well disposed towards them. It was when the bandits started killing the rubber tappers out when they were picking up the rubber and so on, and when they started causing incidents and so on out in the rubber because they were not winning, that the local population tended to turn against them. I read quite a bit about the history of the Malay People's Anti-Japanese Army, which they were, being the only real resistance in the war. They expected to take over running Malaya at the end of the war, but Chin Peng and his people, he was the chief there, started this incidents against the local population, which gradually turned them. Although, from my personal estimation and what I'd seen, communism in Malaya would have been no different. They couldn't have been any worse off than some of the conditions they lived in anyway, under, if you like, the rule of the plantation managers and so on. But towards the end, I think the whole population turned against the bandits. But there were obviously some within the villages who were prepared to supply these people, whether they were relatives or not, out of the jungle and so on, I don't know. But I think towards the end, the population turned. But certainly at the beginning, there was quite a lot that said, yes, you know, we'll help you.
Did you see bad living conditions?
Yes, at night we had to go around. Remember one particular incident where we were looking for food or weapons and something in this village. So we duly had to go through these rubber tapper houses, and where you get 15 to 20 people living in these shacks, it is not good. They certainly couldn't be any worse, with toilets out the back and possibly the odd pig living in with them as well. But again, that was the way they lived. But certainly it was not very good whatsoever.
Did you see any evidence of the pressure the guerrillas put on the local people?
I can't say I did. No, I can't say I did. I think the police or the local, you know, police force would know this, but no, I can't say this.
What was the attitude of local people towards you as a soldier?
In the towns, they were quite happy. As a local soldier, what did you do when you were off duty? You went down to the local markets. The traders there were quite happy to see you. As shopkeepers, it was mainly the Indian population who were the shopkeepers there. Again, there were very, very few Indian terrorists. So the Indians, no, they welcomed you. The local Malays, well, there are people that don't like to do a great deal of work. They, again, were nothing at all. For amusement, obviously, there was the dance halls, and the Chinese girls were very welcoming, shall we say, in all sense. And they had a particular grapevine, if you like. One, again, we were doing or having to go out on an operation the next day. So obviously the lads went out to enjoy themselves the night before. And it was reported that one of the dance hall girls said to her partner, a soldier, "You're going out on an operation, I believe, tomorrow." And the company commander, previous to that, had said, "Well, what information I'm going to tell you now?" He said, "My wife's already told me, so I'm not sure how good the security was, but certainly the young ladies of the time had a pretty good grapevine as to know what was going on." But generally, in town, unlike the situation you would get in Aden, where you would get shot down if you weren't careful, in Limassol and so on, in Kuala Lumpur or the main cities, no, there was no terrorist activity whatsoever. It was all confined to the jungle and the rubber. And that, I think, was the difference. In town, you could really enjoy yourself. You didn't have to carry a weapon around at all. So, you know, the relations with the local population was extremely good.
And in the countryside, what was their attitude towards you there?
We didn't come in contact with them, really, in the villages. You drove through a village, out to the operation. You did your road checks in the morning. They accepted it. There was no conversation whatsoever because the Chinese rubber tappers and that didn't speak English, and certainly none of us spoke Chinese. If you met a rubber tapper on his legal work there, there was no real conversation. He might grin at you or wave at you, but no real communication. You couldn't go and talk to the villagers or anything like that. We never did. We never did.
How much danger did you personally feel yourself to be in whilst you were serving in Malaya?
None whatsoever. You accepted the fact that in the jungle, possibly things could happen. You felt you were really on top of the situation. And I don't really think anybody was apprehensive. They were quite eager to get out. Remember, we had a great percentage of national servicemen in those days, and they were there to do a particular job. It wasn't like getting stuck back in some remote place in England for your 18 months to 2 years. They were out there to do a job. They were eager to get out and to complete the job. With the rest of us, no, we, in my particular case, being a sergeant, all my colleagues were aged 21, 22, 23, 24. If you like, in the prime of our life, we thought nothing that we were going to get shot. If somebody did accidentally get shot or was killed, right, it was an accepted situation. But there was no sort of apprehension whatsoever, I don't think, on anybody's part on this. We accepted it and we got on and did our job.
Did you and your comrades feel eager to get out into the jungle, or did anybody dread going into the jungle?
No, we enjoyed it. We enjoyed it. Strange to relate, it's any of my colleagues of my era, when we meet, we always say those 2.5, 3 years were the best years of our lives because we were doing a job, we enjoyed it, we were being soldiers, if you like, on that, as opposed to marching round various camps. We were actually there to do a job and we were doing the job.
Despite the discomforts of the jungle?
You learn to live with those. Again, the jungle is neutral. You quickly learn how to adapt. In fact, we had the most wonderful toilets you could wish for at times. We had people that took delight in making comfortable toilets that you could use. You had your hammock, which was quite waterproof. You had your plastic covering for it, which you adapted, you bought. You used the parachute cords that came down with your airdrops. They were very handy for tying up your hammocks. We could build tables out there. You could get the airdrop. We did